Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. I'm Lauren.
Hi, I'm Yaja. I'm co-hosting.
And I'm really excited about today's show. We've been talking about it on the air actually for quite a while now. Trying to hook things up on community radio is always a bit of a task. But we're going to be interviewing Gary Francione. And Gary Francione is quite well known, I would say, within the animal rights community. He's a professor of law at Rutgers University School of Law, as well as the author of such books as Rain Without Thunder, The Ideology of the Animal Rights Movement, Animals, Property, and the Law, Ethics and Actions, and Introduction to Animal Rights, Your Child or the Dog, as well as numerous published articles. And to say that Francione is controversial is, you know, quite an understatement. He disturbs people in and outside of the animal rights movement. He challenges, I guess, the welfarist mentality, welfare-type actions, even if they're done under the guise of animal rights. So he definitely pushes people's buttons, so we're really looking forward to talking with him today. I'm not sure if he's on the line right now. Gary, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, super.
Well, jump right into it.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for being on the show today.
My pleasure.
I think we'll probably just start off with some general questions. Your most recent book is called Introduction to Animal Rights, Your Child or the Dog. And I was wondering if you could just reflect on why you chose that title and why you chose that question as sort of a grounding.
You mean Your Child or the Dog?
Your Child or the Dog as a question to launch a discussion about animal rights.
Well, you know, I've been doing this now for about 20 years, and if I had 5 cents for every time someone said to me, well, you believe in animal rights, but if it were a question of your child or the dog, which one would you save?
Right.
And I've always thought it's sort of a crazy question, but, you know, I chose it because I think it is, you know, I was actually writing this book for a general audience, for people who really didn't, who weren't familiar with the animal rights question, and for whom one of the first things that comes to their mind when they think about the animal rights issue is they say, well, if you believe animals have rights, then that would mean you would sacrifice, you know, that you think it's all right to choose an animal over a human in a situation of true conflict. And what I was trying to do with that, and one of the things I argue in the book is that, you know, if I were walking by a burning house and I saw an elderly person who I knew was dying of a terminal illness and a young person, you know, two human animals in that house, and I had time to save only one, and I could, I mean, by definition, I couldn't save both. So I ran in and I saved the young person simply because I made a decision that nothing I would do in that situation would be morally perfect. I could only do what I could do, and I would save the young person. Does that mean it's okay to use elderly people in biomedical experiments or eat them or put them in rodeos, circuses, or zoos? And the answer is, of course not. Mm-hmm. So even if I were walking by the burning house, confronted with saving a human or an animal, and I chose to save the human, what does that tell us? I mean, it doesn't tell us that it's okay to eat animals or to use them in experiments or anything like that. It tells us that in situations of true conflict, we have to make choices. And one of the primary themes of my book is to say, in 99.99999% of the cases, the conflicts that we have with non-human animals are conflicts that we have created because we domesticate them, we bring them into existence for the sole purpose of exploiting them, and then we sit around wringing our hands saying, what are our moral obligations to animals? So I wanted to use that question to sort of launch a whole series of different themes and issues and discuss them for people who really weren't familiar with the animal rights question. And I want to add one thing, and that is, when I talk about animal rights, I think a lot of confusion, amongst people who aren't familiar with it, indeed people who are familiar with it, I mean, there's a lot of confusion about what animal rights means. And are we saying that animals have the same rights as humans? And the answer is, well, I'm not. I mean, there may be some people, and I think there are some people who do maintain that animals have the same rights as humans. I maintain animals have one right, the right not to be property. Mm-hmm. I don't even understand when folks start talking about, well, the various rights that animals should have, and I start thinking, what exactly are people talking about? Because, I mean, when people say, well, should the cow have the right to sue? Because I'm a lawyer and a law professor, and people say, well, should a cow have the right to sue the farmer? And to me, that's sort of a silly question. The question for me is, why is the cow there in the first place? And if animals weren't property, we wouldn't domesticate animals and we wouldn't be bringing them into existence for the purpose of exploiting them.
Mm-hmm.
So my thesis is that, and my argument is that, that animals have one right, the right not to be property. Of course, once we give them that one right, once we accord them and recognize they have that one right, the world changes dramatically,
mm-hmm.
because it means we can no longer engage in the institutional exploitation that we engage in every second of every minute of every day, which assumes that animals are nothing but property.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to shift the focus a little bit to what I saw as one of the central themes of the central theme of Rain Without Thunder, and you are very clear about trying to differentiate between rightist discourse, rightist philosophy, and a welfare philosophy.
Sure.
And I was wondering if you could just explain that to our listeners, why that's an important distinction, and what you meant in the book by new welfarists.
Well, in the 19th century in the United States, there were two groups of people with respect to two positions with respect to human slavery. There were those who said that we have to regulate human slavery to make it more humane. And then there were those people who said the institution of slavery is inherently wrong and needs to be abolished, and we must reject it. It's morally unconscionable. And the people in the latter group who believed that slavery should be abolished did not agree with or support efforts by the regulationists, the people who believe that slavery had to be regulated, to make slavery a more, quote, humane institution.
Mm-hmm.
So they would not support laws that would make slavery more humane. Their position is, we can't buy into this at all. Slavery is wrong. It should be abolished, and we need to be moving towards the abolition of slavery rather than trying to make slavery a more humane institution. I mean, it's, you know, you can put a symphony in a concentration camp and provide music for people on the way to the gas chambers, but it's still a concentration camp. And so what I tried to argue in Rain Without Thunder was that, as a theoretical matter, there's a huge difference between welfare and rights. It's the same difference that existed between the regulation of slavery and the abolition of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
But I also argued in Rain Without Thunder that there was absolutely no proof whatsoever that welfareism worked. That, I mean, for those people who argued that welfareism was a way of reducing suffering now for animals, the answer is that's nonsense. There is absolutely no empirical evidence whatsoever to suggest that welfareist reforms actually do result in the reduction of suffering, or any significant reduction of suffering for any significant number of animals.
Mm-hmm.
Welfareism, when I use the expression new welfareism, what I meant was those people who call themselves animal rights people and who believe in the ultimate end of abolition, but who believe that regulation is a way to abolition. And to those people, I argued, look, folks, again, there is no historical evidence whatsoever that welfareism has ever led to the abolition of any practice whatsoever. Indeed, what welfareism tends to do is to further entrench those institutions of exploitation by making people feel better about them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, case in point right now, what's going on in the States, which is really obscene in my judgment, and that is the fact that a number of these animal rights organizations are now busy praising organizations like McDonald's and
mm-hmm.
Burger King because they are supposedly subscribing to new humane slaughtering procedures, etc.
Right.
If you think about that for a second, I mean, first of all, I do not think that that those procedures will, in fact, do very much for animals. Number one, number two, what those procedures will do, and what the praising of those procedures will do by animal rights organizations, is make a lot more people feel a lot more comfortable about eating meat.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, you know, I've had a number of discussions with people, a number of my colleagues at the university say, well, you know, I now feel better about taking my kids to McDonald's because
right.
PETA says that they're, you know, that they're a humane organization
right.
and that they're interested, that they're moving in the right direction. So now I don't feel bad about taking my kids to McDonald's. I don't think that those sort of welfareist things do anything at all except give animal organizations fundraising campaigns and make people feel better about exploiting animals. I don't think they do anything for the animals. So when I talked about new welfareism, I was saying, look, in many ways, the animal rights people now are really no different from the welfareists of the 1950s. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the folks in the 1950s would have agreed also that, well, ultimately one day we'll end it all, but right now we've just got to worry about reforming it.
Mm-hmm.
And the new welfarists are basically taking the same position as the old welfarists did, except, you know, they would rather go naked than wear fur, or whatever it is that they do
right.
these days. And they add that sort of gloss to it and call it radical. It's not radical at all. It's incredibly reactionary.
I wonder if you could if we could talk a little bit more about the concept of animal welfare. And in,
sure.
in the book Rain Without Thunder, you sort of categorize with examples the welfare movement as often being very similar to the animal exploitation movement
yes.
in terms of the goals and the agendas. Can you give some sort of examples of that so people can understand where you're coming from and what you mean by that?
Sure. If you look at most of the welfarist legislation, and I confine my remarks to the United States because my recollection, I did have actually something to do with some Canadian legislation some years ago, but as I get closer to 50, my memory gets more faded, so I don't want to discuss that because I don't remember it well enough. But with respect to the welfarist legislation that we've seen in the United States, things like the Animal Welfare Act, the Humane Slaughter Act, the recent legislation that was passed, the Chimpanzee Health Improvement Maintenance and Protection Act in the United States, which was supported by many of the large animal organizations in the States. These are all pieces of legislation which are by and large supported by the exploiters themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that, you know, I mean, let's take the Animal Welfare Act as an example. The Animal Welfare Act basically doesn't prohibit anything. I mean, in a nutshell, I mean, it's a very long statute and there are a lot of regulations, but to boil it down to sort of one concept, once that laboratory door is closed, those vivisectors can do whatever they want with those animals, and whatever they get the money to do, they can do. The law doesn't do anything to prohibit, you know, to prohibit any particular forms of experimentation. What the Animal Welfare Act does is to say, you've got to give them a certain amount of food, you've got to give them a certain amount of water, unless they're involved in food deprivation or water deprivation
right.
experiments. You've got to give them a certain cage space. And the rationale, I mean, you know, the biomedical community went along with the Animal Welfare Act because they took the position, well, look, if you are not providing food and water in enough space to the animal, then the animal will have stress that the animal suffers over and above that of the stress that the animal feels in the experiment, and that may confound the variables, you know, and thereby threaten the integrity of the scientific data that comes out of those experiments.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very odd sort of union where you had the animal movement and the vivisectors all agreeing that the Animal Welfare Act was a good thing. Same thing with the Humane Slaughter Act of 1958. It was supported by the animal movement. It was also supported by the animal agriculture industry, because one of the things that the Humane Slaughter Act did was, by requiring animals be stunned before they're shackled and hoisted, it cuts down on the number of work-related injuries and the number of lawsuits they face from workers that are injured.
Mm.
You know, and with almost all of these welfarist pieces of legislation, generally they get so watered down that because the only way they will pass, the only way the legislation as a matter of real politics, as a matter of pragmatic politics, the only way these things pass is if industry goes along with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only way industry goes along with them is to water them down to the point where they basically serve some interest of industry. And you know, so it's a win-win situation, at least. It's a win-win situation for everybody except the animals. It's a win situation for the animal people, because then they can go back to their donors and to the public and say, look at the wonderful things we've done, give us more money. And it's a win situation for industry, because industry then, you know, industry can then promote itself as doing, quote, the humane thing.
Mm-hmm.
But industry also gets the benefits of a decrease of worker-related injuries. Industry also gets the benefit of better science, or at least what they would claim is better scientific data, which is not confounded by variables of stress from the result of deprivation of food and water and you know, space and things like that. So, you know, it in almost all these situations that I have seen and studied, and I spent a good deal of my academic life and my professional life as a lawyer working on these sorts of things,
mm-hmm.
I can't think of one instance, not one instance of welfarist legislation that's done anything to help animals.
Mm-hmm.
I can give you lots of examples of welfarist legislation from which animal organizations have made trillions of dollars in, you know, campaign contributions. I cannot think, and I can give you examples of situations where industry and research has benefited from welfarist legislation. I can't give you one example of a piece of legislation where the animals have benefited.
Mm-hmm. I was interested if we could talk about something like, I think it's Farm Sanctuary right now, that they're doing various different campaigns to try to get crating systems banned.
Yeah.
Would you see that as a welfare move then? Or not? How does that sound?
Well, you know, again, I'd have to look at the individual campaign. I mean, look, you see, one of the things I argued, and I'm sorry, I don't know which one of you, so I can't use your names because I don't know which one of you is asking
okay.
the question.
Sorry, that was Lauren.
I'm not trying to be unfriendly or anything.
No, no.
One of the points I made in Rain Without Thunder is maybe we all ought to stop this business of trying to get laws passed and trying to sort of deal with this as a legal matter. I mean, look,
mm-hmm.
let's think about this for a second. I mean, let's assume tomorrow that a law was passed that said you couldn't eat meat. Oh, that'd be great, wouldn't it? Yes, it would be great, and it would result in probably a lot of violence and a revolution because people wouldn't tolerate it.
Right.
The society is not at a point yet. Look, I'm not even sure we're at a point where we think people of color have rights or women have full rights. I mean, I don't believe we're there yet. So I certainly don't think we're at a point where there's a critical mass of people who believe that animals have moral status and that animals should not be property.
Mm-hmm.
If that is in fact true, then it seems to me that we are wasting time and resources trying to solve this problem through legal means,
mm-hmm.
Through court cases and through pieces of legislation. I mean, let's just do a thought experiment for a second. Let's assume that all the resources of all of the animal groups, and the animal groups have lots of money.
Mm-hmm.
If we took all of those resources and we had a sustained campaign to relentlessly educate every man, woman, and child, anyone that we could get our hands on, educate them about the virtues and values of a vegan diet. Mm-hmm. And we did that for 5 years. My guess is at the end of the 5 years, and I'll be real conservative about this, something I'm not normally, a conservative person, that at the end of 5 years, we would certainly, if we all did this, if all of us who are interested in this, if Farm Sanctuary, PETA, and all these other groups got together and educated people about veganism,
mm-hmm.
my guess is at the end of the 5 years, you would have at least 1,000 more vegans.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the end of 5 years, if you have 1,000 more vegans, and you compare that with whatever you would get as a result of putting the same number of dollars and the same amount of person power and labor into those campaigns to, you know, get veal crates banned or whatever people are talking about,
mm-hmm.
my guess is you would reduce a lot more suffering if you had 1,000 more vegans than you would have certainly a lot more. I'm just using that as a ridiculously low number. Certainly you'd have a lot more.
Right.
And see, the question is, we're sort of stuck in a rut,
mm-hmm.
where we think that the way to solve the problem is the law. And the problem is the law is always a bad device to use when you don't have a critical mass of people who agree morally with the underlying moral theory that the law is trying to implement.
Mm-hmm.
Case in point, abortion in the United States. You know, in 1973, the Supreme Court hands down Roe versus Wade and says women have a right to terminate pregnancy. Now, you know, the reason why the Supreme Court did that in 1973 is the Supreme Court realized that no state legislature, that the federal legislatures and the federal legislature and state legislature were not about to give women that right as a legislative matter because there were too many people who disagreed with the morality of abortion. The result is, from the moment Roe was handed down, that decision has been eroded and eroded and eroded and eroded to the point now where about 70 to 80% of the women in the United States don't even live near an abortion provider. Abortion has been so severely restricted and regulated, even though it's still a constitutional right and will probably be a constitutional right until George Bush gets the next Supreme Court appointment, and then it won't be a constitutional right anymore. But right now it's a constitutional right that for many women is meaningless. And the reason for that is that there are too many people in the United States, wrongly in my view, I support very strongly the right to terminate the right of a woman to choose to terminate pregnancy, but I mean there are too many people who don't agree with that. They who don't agree with the argument that abortion is necessary if women are to ever overcome second class status and and the problems of patriarchy, that abortion, that the right to terminate pregnancy is a necessary right. That, you know, I mean, there aren't enough people who agree with that position. And the result is you can use the law in that situation, but the result will be exactly what the result has become.
Mm-hmm.
The law will be meaningless for most women, mm-hmm. and the moment they have an opportunity, the law will be reversed. So I, you know, part of the problem I have with the way most of these animal groups approach this is they think, well, you know, we've got to have campaigns. And, you know, I understand it's a business thing. I mean, it's a business issue. Mm-hmm. You know, you're running an animal rights group. You've got to keep going to the public continually to raise money. You don't raise money by telling them you've got wonderful educational programs that are teaching people about the virtues of a vegan diet. You raise money from people by telling them, we've got this great lawsuit. We've got this great piece of legislation. This is going to be great. This is going to make a huge difference. And the answer is, it's nonsense. I mean, case in point, look at Farm Sanctuary's campaign about the Downed Animal Act. I mean, that is, I wrote about that in Rain Without Thunder.
Yeah.
I mean, the Downed Animal Act didn't do anything whatsoever to address the issue of non-ambulatory animals. The law was so watered down, by the time it got to the California legislature, the law was so watered down that the California veal producers and all of the other meat producers in California and indeed throughout the country were supporting the legislation. Because it basically didn't do anything. And when I hear Farm Sanctuary say that it gives them the right to go on to the property and it gives them the right to demand this and that, the answer is that's nonsense. Look at the law. The law doesn't give Farm Sanctuary any rights to do anything, nor does it require that those animals be killed immediately. It says removed or killed immediately. And the reality is that the same stuff that was going on before is going on now. And the only difference is there are a lot of folks out there who think, at least in California, the problem has been solved. Mm-hmm. The answer is, no, it hasn't. No, it hasn't. It hasn't been solved at all. The non-ambulatory animal problem still exists in California, despite what Farm Sanctuary says. But again, you've got to understand, Farm Sanctuary is a business. It's got to keep that money coming in order to keep running. And in order to do that, you got to have campaigns, or at least that's the perception. You've got to have campaigns. I believe that if the animal people would only get together and have a unified message of abolition, they might not get any laws passed for the next 10 years, but they could educate a lot of people so that maybe one day effective laws could start being passed.
Mm.
But right now, the idea that we're ever going to get any meaningful legislation when animal agriculture is second only to oil in terms of the number of dollars represented as an economic activity is crazy.
Right.
I mean, I am often criticized for being utopian. I think that is real. I find that comical. What's utopian and what's unrealistic is the belief of the welfarists and of the new welfarists that they're going to solve this problem by getting pieces of legislation, you know, downed animal acts, veal crate bans, things like that. Those things never work. They always get watered down to the point where they're absolutely meaningless because that's the only way they're going to get passed.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, when you are fighting animal agriculture, you are dealing with a huge it's an enormous economic activity. That's, you're not going to get any meaningful legislation until you have a critical mass of people who really believe that there are serious moral issues raised by our treatment of non-humans and who are willing. I mean, look, the bottom line is, I've been doing this work for 20 years, and I can tell you there are a lot of leaders of the animal rights movement who aren't vegans. There are a lot of animal rights people who aren't even vegetarians, but there are a lot of leaders of the movement who aren't vegetarians or vegans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really the problem. Because really, you know, if you really believe in abolition, you might not be able to affect it throughout the world tomorrow, but you can affect it in your life right now.
Mm-hmm.
You can apply the principle of abolition in your life right now and become a vegan.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I know lots of animal rights people who aren't vegans. Lots and lots and lots of them. Indeed, I know more leaders of the animal rights movement in the United States. I'm not speaking about Canada. I don't know enough about the Canadian movement. But in the United States, I know more of the leaders of the animal rights movement, they're not vegans, than are vegans. So I guess if you're not willing to apply the principle of abolition in your own life, if that cheese pizza or that ice cream or that odd bit of fish is something that, you know, you still have to have, well, then I guess it doesn't surprise me that you think that my ideas are wrong. But that's okay.
Thank you for that. scary. It's very inspiring, to say the least. Najee, you think you had a question?
Yeah, I was trying to picture someone listening and feeling just sort of overwhelmed and sort of frustrated about work that they might be doing. So I think a lot of people feel that they give support to a lot of campaigns because they think that they will make difference. So what would you suggest to people at the individual level? What's the most effective things that they can do to empower themselves and to feel like they're empowering animals and working towards an abolitionist goal?
The very first thing, the necessary first step is to become a vegan. Mm-hmm. That is the, you know, you want to empower animals, you want to do something for animals, stop eating them, wearing them, using them. Stop buying into the system of exploitation. Stop buying into it completely. Mm-hmm. And let me say this. If enough people took that first step and enough people really understood that this issue is so important that however much I love that piece of cheese pizza, however much I love that ice cream, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. You know, and I have to tell you, let me continue with the question. I think that, are there things that people can do? And the answer is right now, as I argued in Rain Without Thunder, and I think I wrote that book in 1996, and what I said in 1996, I still maintain. Right now, the thing that we all need to do is to educate other people. And we need to make ourselves aware of the arguments. We need to learn. I mean, I frequently see I'm very distressed when I see animal rights people running up to people wearing fur coats and screaming at them. You don't educate people by screaming at them. You educate them by getting them to understand your point of view. People, I mean, I've been a teacher for 20 years, and I have a fairly good reputation as a teacher. And the one thing that I have tried to do over the years is try to understand that, you've got to persuade the student. You don't come from on high with the truth. You've got to explain you've got to explain your position and argue your position to people. Many of the animal rights people I know, yes, they want to do work and things like that, and they're really interested in helping animals, but they won't sit down and they won't read. They won't make themselves knowledgeable about how to answer questions, like when someone says, yes, but we've been eating meat for many, many years. It's a tradition, or isn't it natural to eat meat? Or, but animals eat each other. How about, you need to have an answer to people's questions. When they ask you those questions, you need to have an answer, which is another reason why I wrote Introduction to Animal Rights, was because I have this appendix in the back of the book in which I deal with a lot of these questions. And the idea was to sort of arm people with knowledge so they could go and educate other people. You don't need to be involved in flashy campaigns. You don't need a whole lot of money to do this. But what we need to be doing is educating people, making people aware of how meat is produced, how dairy products are produced, and provoking people to confront the moral, I'm teaching a course this semester in law and philosophy, and yesterday we started talking about the concept of personhood. And, I said to my students, I said, I started talking about the animal issue. And I said, I'll make an argument that you ought to become vegans, and I won't even mention animal rights. And they all sort of, chuckled and said, no, you can't do that. And I said, sure, I can. I said, how many people here disagree with the principle that it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering on animals? And they all raised, every single student raised his or her hand. And then I made the argument that if that principle means anything, if necessity means anything, it means pleasure, amusement, or convenience can't be a sufficient justification for imposing pain. I mean, if you have a rule that says you can't, that unnecessary pain is wrong, and the imposition of unnecessary pain is wrong, but it's okay to do it if it brings you pleasure and amusement or convenience, then the rule that it's wrong to inflict unnecessary pain becomes meaningless. Mm-hmm. And so I got them all to, I said, now, would you all agree that if necessity means anything at all, its minimal meaning has to be that pleasure, amusement, or convenience can't justify eating, the imposition of pain or suffering. They all agreed with that. And then I basically said, well, now it's 2002. Nobody, not even the United States government, the prime disseminator of disinformation in the universe, maintains that you need to eat meat to lead an optimally healthy lifestyle. Indeed, an increasing number of mainstream healthcare people are maintaining that the more animal products you eat, the more danger you have to your health. Mm-hmm. Bottom line is, the best justification we have for inflicting suffering, pain, and death on 9 billion creatures every single year is they taste good. if you take the principle that it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering seriously, you got to go home tonight, and before you put any of that stuff in your mouth again, you got to ask yourself a question. Do I take morality seriously, in which case you got to put the fork down? Or am I just a BSer who says he or she takes moral ideas seriously but really doesn't?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you something. It provoked an hour and a half discussion that was just absolutely, you know, and I think a lot of the students walked out of there. I hope a lot of the students walked out of there at least thinking about, and I didn't even mention animal rights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I really think that it's important to educate people and to provoke them to think about this issue. Most people, and maybe I'm being naive about this, in which case efforts at education are useless, but so are efforts at legislation useless.
Right.
But I think most people take, or at least like to think that they take moral ideas seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is to persuade them, and the idea is to educate them. And that's, we've never done that as a movement. We instead jump to step 12 rather than taking steps 1 through 11. You are never going to get any meaningful legislation or any meaningful social change on this issue at all unless there's a critical number of people who believe that animals matter, that animals have moral status, that animals ought not to be property. And as long as you got your supposedly radical animal rights organizations saying, oh yes, McDonald's is doing just fine. I mean, put aside the fact, I mean, I think the whole McDonald's thing is obscene for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, not only because of the way McDonald's treats its workers, but it's not just a question of the animals, it's the way they treat their workers, what McDonald's does to the environment. And there are a whole host of things that McDonald's does that, in my judgment, are quite wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And to have your supposedly animal rights or your radical animal organization saying, well, they're going in the right direction, and you know they're making really significant changes. That's not it. What that is doing is confusing people. It's not educating people about the horrors of the slaughterhouse and the horrors of how meat and dairy is produced, how leather is produced, and all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's confusing people,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's confusing them very, very much. And that's why people are saying to me, "Hey, are you going to start eating?" I mean, I had another professor at the university say to me, are you going to start eating meat again? And I said, what are you talking about?
Right.
and he said, well, but I just read in the paper over the weekend that PETA, isn't that group? And I said, look, you know, I haven't had anything to do with PETA in over a decade. But, you know, he said, but, you know, the PETA people, and they're supposed to be the far out ones, aren't they? I mean, they say that McDonald's is really moving in the right direction. And so doesn't that change your thinking? And I said, no, not at all. But you see, that's the sort of effect that those sorts of campaigns have.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do any good for animals. What they do is they get publicity for PETA. They get a hell, I mean, I will tell you, if I was the chairman of McDonald's, I would have made that deal in a heartbeat. I mean, come on. I mean, you know, you get the endorsement of a radical, supposedly radical, it's a very reactionary sexist organization, but you get it's become a very radical, a very reactionary and sexist organization, but you get the endorsement of this supposedly radical animal rights organization to say that, you know, you're going in the right direction, you're producing humane hamburgers. Well, hell, I'd take that deal in a second.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, that's a no-brainer if you're McDonald's.
Gary, I'm really curious to hear what kind of reaction you have from people in the animal rights community. Do you find that any of the larger organizations are even open to this kind of dialogue?
Oh, absolutely not. When I wrote Rain Without Thunder, I actually had people spit on me at conferences.
Whoa.
I got death threats. This is what I really enjoy it. I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years. And I get, you know, vivisectors get upset. I mean, I debate vivisectors all the time. I go to universities and medical schools, and I debate vivisectors. Do they get upset with me? Sure they do. Nobody ever calls me names. No one ever calls and makes death threats. I mean, I have had some hunters give me death threats over the years and things like that. But I've had much more violent reactions from these supposedly peace-loving animal people than I've gotten from, all of the exploiters put together multiplied by five. I mean, you know, I've been beaten up by police at demonstrations, and I actually was once assaulted by a vivisector. He actually kicked me in the head. And I've had my share of, you know, as I said, hunters, you know, I've had some issues with hunters over the past few years and whatnot. But I've had much more violence expressed to me by the peace lovers and the supposedly compassionate animal people. And that upset, that makes me very sad. It makes me very sad when I'm at a conference speaking. One of the reasons why I don't speak at really many very animal rights conferences anymore is I don't wish to have these, you know, I'm just getting too old for that sort of stuff. You know, to have young people come up to me and spit on me and say that I'm a traitor because I've criticized PETA. you know, I find that very disconcerting. But yeah, it happens all the time. No, I mean, you know, interestingly, I find it interesting that there are very few organizations, even though Introduction to Animal Rights is a far more radical book than Animal Liberation, which is actually, I mean, and that's one of the things I discuss in that book, is Peter Singer's views actually are really the foundation of new welfareism, and I think Peter has done, you know, by taking the position that anything that decreases suffering is something that we ought to pursue, any measure that you can think of in your heads, any measure whatsoever, I could describe for you in some way that it will decrease suffering. If it decreases suffering for one animal, Peter says, then you ought to do it. Well, then that basically means that, you know, anything goes, and any idiotic welfarist campaign that people can devise can always be packaged, you know, as decreasing suffering. And I think that, you know, in fact, you know, the whole utilitarian philosophy has bolstered that sort of meaningless pursuit of meaningless legislation and meaningless court reforms and things like that. But clearly that book is more radical than Animal Liberation, and it even goes much further than Tom Reagan's book, The Case for Animal Rights. I mean, Tom limits, for Tom, in order to be a right holder, you have to be a being that has a certain preference autonomy. And my argument is that sentience alone is all you need for membership in the moral community. So my book actually goes much further than either Animal Liberation or The Case for Animal Rights. But very few of the animal rights groups are promoting it because they don't like my views. And I still have a whole file of letters that I got in 96 and 97 when I wrote Rain Without Thunder, where people actually sent me a large number of death threats. And, you know, that's the thing. I mean, it's really interesting because That's what's so very interesting to me about, you know, the only people who attack me more, you know, who attack me more than the exploiters are the animal people. You know, they're the people who, I mean, they're the people who criticize me more and more personally. You know, they make, you know, I mean, vivisectors will say, you know, will take issue with me and say that my ideas are wrong or that my ideas are radical or this or that. And that my ideas are too far out, or they're, you know, they're too out of sync, or that I'm a, you know, socialist. You know, they'll say things like that.
Right.
But the animal people will attack me personally, and they'll say really horrible things, and they will engage in violent acts towards me. I find that really very disconcerting.
Mm. So, what do you think would be a forum where some of these ideas can be exchanged, and to try and for the movement to have some kind of re-energizing and maybe just re-evaluating where people are going.
Conversation.
Yeah,
well, you know, I wish I had an answer. I mean, you know, my view is I just keep doing what I'm doing. I keep writing my books. I keep doing radio shows like this. I do television shows. I do university debates. I'm doing a very, very, I'm giving a keynote address at the University of Richmond and at the end of March, where I will be, you know, amongst some of the most prominent philosophers in North America, giving a presentation on these sorts of issues. As far as the organized movement is concerned, I'm not sure that there's I don't hold out a whole lot of hope that discourse and discussion like mine is ever. I mean, if you're running an animal rights group, I'm about as high on your list of people to include in the discussion as Dracula would be. I mean, in the sense of you know, obviously people like Farm Sanctuary and PETA aren't interested in discussion or dialogue with me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I find that sad. I mean, I think it's sad that, you know, I've known Lori and Jean, people at Farm Sanctuary, I've known them for, I don't know, almost 20 years. I mean, I've known them for a long time. And Ingrid and Alex, Ingrid Newkirk and Alex Pacheco, I met when, you know, I first got involved with this, and I was, you know, PETA's first sort of general counsel many, 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 many years ago in the very early 1980s, when I was a lot younger than I am now. But the thing is that, you know, there's really no discussion with these people on these issues. I mean, I've tried to have discussions with them, and they're not interested. I mean, I remember when Farm Sanctuary was going to have a big bash to celebrate the movie Babe, they wanted me to, you know, to endorse it and to come out and speak, etc. And I said, no, I will have nothing to do with that. I will have nothing to do with a movie in which animals were used, and in which animals were killed, in which animals were injured. I will have nothing. I don't care whether it is a pro-animal message. To me, it would be like making a movie with a pro-woman message in which a woman was raped. Yeah. I would not tolerate that. I would not support that either, even if it had a good message. Mm-hmm. I would add as a footnote, you know, for those people who think Babe had such a great message, I wonder why McDonald's appropriated it immediately and started putting out Babe Happy Meals. I mean, obviously, the educational value of the film was somewhat lost.
Right.
But I, you know, and I remember having a discussion with them and saying, look, how is this any different from making a movie about women's rights and raping a woman? How is it any different? And, you know, nobody has an answer for that except, Gary, just stop with this and just cooperate. You know, just stop and cooperate. And the answer is no, I'm not interested in cooperating. I'm not a corporate boy. I'm not really interested. I mean, you know, I'm not interested in, you know, the corporate animal welfare business. I'm not interested in the big business. I'm not interested in their millions of dollars and whether they have successful. I'm just not interested in their campaigns and stuff like that. I'm interested in focusing them. They don't wish to be focused. They don't even wish to discuss these issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we're having a conference. The Friends of Animals is one of the few exceptions to the rule, where it's also one of the few organizations that is headed by a woman who, Priscilla Farrell, who takes feminism seriously. And she also, I mean, that's part of the other problem is that the movement has never recognized the connections between other social justice movements, which is why you have groups like PETA with these idiotic, I'd rather go naked than wear fur. I mean, I think PETA has sort of gone so far over the edge in terms of its sexism. You know, and I used to always say to Ingrid Newkirk, you know, the problem, you know, as long as we continue to treat women like pieces of meat, we're going to continue to treat meat like pieces of meat.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to really, you know, this, because I, that was one of the reasons why I stopped having anything to do with PETA was many years ago when they started with these, I'd rather go naked than do whatever campaigns. I said to them, look, you know, if we think speciesism is bad because it's like racism and sexism, then we have a position on racism and sexism, namely racism and sexism are bad, and that we ought not to be promoting sexism and racism. And I think that those anti-fur campaigns and some of the more recent campaigns they've had, which have actually been, in my judgment, just outrageously stupid and silly, are very, very sexist. But Priscilla Farrell at Friends of Animals is one of the few leaders of the organized movement who takes feminism seriously. And a couple of years ago, she had a conference in which we talked about the connections between feminism and the civil rights movement and these sorts of things. And we're going to have another conference. I think she's got it scheduled in September. People who are interested can contact Friends of Animals and find out. And we're going to talk about, you know, these issues, you know, the relationship with other social justice movements and, you know, issues of grassroots activism. I mean, I think one of the things that has to be done if we're ever going to see a truly vibrant movement emerge is to get people out of the mind state of animal rights activism is, you know, taking out your checkbook and writing a check to one of these groups. That's not activism. What activism is getting, you know, getting yourself off the couch and, you know, going and talking to your neighbors and people, your friends, and going to places and spreading the message and trying to educate people. Going to other social justice movements and trying to get those folks. I spend a lot of my time talking to people in other, dare I say, left-wing movements, because, you know, I have always believed that the animal rights movement is a left-wing movement, and it should be a left-wing movement. And I spend a lot of my time talking to people on the left about the importance of seeing the connections, you know, that, yeah, you can be all for social justice and women's rights, but why aren't you also for animal rights? I mean, why, you know, why do you draw the line? You know, if you believe that these lines are arbitrary with respect to humans, why do you think that they all of a sudden become non-arbitrary when we erect them, you know, when we erect a species barrier? And so, you know, I think that, you know, but if we're ever going to have a vibrant movement, we really got to get people away from this business that, you know, animal rights activism is, let me take out my wallet and give you a donation. That's not activism, you know, and one of the things that's happened with the emergence of these large organizations is that they infantilize people. They sort of say, look, you know, we'll run it, we'll do it. You know, we're the corporation. We know what's best. You know, we'll run the campaigns. We'll do the campaigns. What you need to do is, you know, sort of come on Thursday nights to our volunteer meetings and stuff envelopes and make sure you write checks to us and make sure you get other people to write checks to us. But we're not training people to be educators and to be activists. And I want to be real clear on this. I'm talking about nonviolent educational activities. That's the sort of activism I'm talking about. I mean, I think education is the most potent form of activism that you can engage in. And we have failed in that. We're not training educators to go out and educate. You know, we have corporations. We have animal corporations. We have an animal rights. We don't have an animal rights movement. We have an animal rights industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
We have Mark with us as well, who's our technician, but he sometimes joins in and co-hosts, and he has a question for you.
Sure.
Oh, hey, hey, Gary. It was actually very refreshing what you've been saying so far, and I have very similar views. I discuss much with my partner about this whole issue around the animal movement industry, per se. And if you could just comment, because I know that there's an annual event that's, you know, been going annually, I think, for the past few years in Washington, D.C. And I noticed there was another big kind of animal rights movement that was organizing called the Liberation Conference, and I think it's supposed to be, like, youth-oriented, and it's an animal rights conference, and yet it was really absurd, I felt, when I saw the speakers that were slotted to speak at this event, because I felt that it's the same speakers that have been speaking for the past 10 years or so, probably speaking on the same thing or slightly adjusted talk that was given the year before. And I was wondering if you could just comment on I forget what it's called, the Animal Rights Conference or something.
AR 2002.
Yeah,
is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, if you could comment on that, because I just find it's the same problem, not just in Washington, but in many other conferences. And that you get the same speakers speaking literally on the same things, and it even happens here with the Toronto. We have a vegetarian annual conference,
yeah,
or a food fair,
yeah,
and it's just it's become a really I don't know, I'm very disappointed with it, to put it lightly, and because, you know, for the past 5 or 10 years, they've been just having the same speakers, and it's you know, you go there, you know, to get cheap ice cream sandwiches, vegan ones, that's the main point of going there, rather than to actually, like, see what people are talking about, and not only is it the same speakers, but I find that the people who are organizing these events are not putting in the effort that they should be to be more inclusive on a real, because there's such a diversity of people who hold these kind of values, and yet they're not making any effort whatsoever to actually try to contact these people, because there's so many different people who have similar values, and yet. And I really wonder why. It's because it's like maybe they want to think like, oh, these people are known, so they're popular, so they'll draw people. Like, what's your take on that? Because it's a real, like, issue for me, and
sure.
I find it really frustrating.
I agree with you completely. Right? I mean, what happens is AR 2002, for example. You know, these are celebrity events, you know, and I used to do these things through the 80s and some of the 90s, and then I just decided that my idea of hell was sort of, you know, for eternity speaking at animal rights conferences with the same people, to the same people.
Right.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, the people who are speaking, but you see, look at it. Your name is Mark, right?
Yes.
Mark, yeah. Mark, if you counted the number of vegans who are speaking at AR 2002, there wouldn't be many. So, I mean, basically what you've got is a bunch of welfarists from organizations like HSUS and you know, you've got a lot of other welfarists speaking there. Look, the bottom line is the animal rights movement / industry doesn't want to really shake things up, because if they want to shake things up, the first thing that's going to go is the corporate mindset of the new, the corporate structure of new welfareism. These are large organizations, you know, where people are knocking down, you know, very, very large salaries. I mean, you know, many people in the animal rights movement in the States are making well over $100,000. I mean, well over $100,000 in salary benefits and in other things that they get as part of their expense accounts and things like that. I mean, some of those people at HSUS, for example, are making well over $200,000, and some of them over $300,000 a year. So, I mean, this is the establishment. You know, PETA is no longer a radical organization. It is part of the establishment. So these organizations are not really interested in shaking things up. The guy who organizes, now, interestingly, and I just want to point to this, the guy who organizes that conference, AR 2002, was recently revealed that, you know, he is also a prominent member of some pro-SNM organization. And I had some discussion with him in which I said, his name is Alex Hirschhaft, and I said, Alex, I said, you know, it seems to me that there's a real serious conflict between the position of nonviolence and the position that we ought to be promoting, we ought to be promoting sadomasochistic pornography, basically. And you know, his response is, well, you know, there's really, you know, that's a separate issue. And I don't see it as a separate issue. I mean, to me, pornography generally, whether it's sadomasochistic or not, pornography is, you know, it's very similar to eating meat. You reduce the person to body parts and you consume them. You negate the personhood through the consumption of body parts.
I know that that's, I know a popular, stance amongst people, but I really have to take issue with that just briefly because I don't want to totally derail this discussion. But it's just like I know that you know the host of this program for the past 5 years before these two started was a prostitute for 10 years and took very very strongly issues around animal rights was actually her greatest passion and I find that a lot of people they talk about SM or prostitution or sex work or pornography without really talking to many people.
I actually have given this a lot of thought, and I'm presently writing something about it. I'm not talking about prostitution. I'm talking about men who promote pornography. That's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about women who are in a situation where economically, the best way they may be able to have independence is to be sex workers. That's a wholly separate issue, and we can discuss that maybe in another show because I think that that's really very interesting. I'm talking about men promoting pornography, and I think that pornography raises some very very serious issues. But the thing is that you know, look, if we aren't even at a point where we believe that pornography and nonviolence sort of, you know, if we think that pornography is consistent with the ethic of nonviolence, then where are we going? I mean, where are we going from there? I mean, I'm not talking about women who choose to be sex workers. That's a whole other issue. I'm talking about men who promote pornography and the pornography establishment. You know, I mean, I think that that raises some very, very serious issues about, you know, its inconsistency with nonviolence. But, I mean, that's the sort of conference where, obviously, they don't want people coming there talking about the relationships between sexism and speciesism. If you're running the conference and you don't see the relationship between sexism and speciesism, then I suggest that you're not going to be very, very excited about other people who are talking about that. And so, you know, these are very reactionary, conservative, male-dominated, patriarchally-oriented, you know, sorts of events where the same people get together, and I agree with you. I mean, you know, I used to go to these conferences, and it would be the same people, conference after conference, the same speakers and the same people. And I would go to, you know, I'd speak at maybe 8 or 9, maybe 10, 12 conferences a year, and I'd see the same people. And I'd say to them, you know, don't you have something better to do than to go to conferences? And then I thought, well, I've got something better to do than to come and speak at them because I'm speaking with the same people to the same people. And the thing that I was finding, Mark, was I would get up and say, you know, abolition is really, you know, essential. We've really got to commit ourselves to abolition. And people would stand up and give, you know, would give me a standing ovation. The next person would get up and say, no, we shouldn't promote abolition. It'll upset too many people. We all ought to, you know, promote welfareist reform. And that person would get a standing ovation. So I decided that obviously, I was dealing with a bunch of people who didn't really know what they thought, and however many conferences they went to, they weren't really getting the message. But I agree with you. I mean, those conferences, Mark, they are showcases for the industry leaders, is what they are. I mean, it's really no different from you know, some group of corporate moguls getting together to talk about, you know, business. Then that's exactly what these people are doing. These are events where only the people who are part of the boys club, who have bought into the idea that we mustn't be too confrontational, we mustn't be too provocative, we mustn't suggest things which are going to offend people. You don't have any progress if you're afraid to risk offending people. I'm not saying you go up and shout at them. I'm not saying that you call them names. Indeed, I'm very, very much opposed to that. I'm saying that you've got to provoke people in terms of getting them to think about their moral views and the foundations of their moral views. And if you're not willing to do that, then what's it all about? I mean, you're wasting your time, in my view. And I think that a lot of these conferences are doing exactly that. They're trotting out the same people who say the same innocuous things. They all get up and say the same things. We ought to be nice to animals. Well, who can disagree with that? that's really a safe sort of thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would, however, say, you know, but it doesn't surprise me, you know, when you look at the people who organize these things and who speak at these things, these are very reactionary people. These are people who are generally very conservative in their views, and they're not really interested in, I mean, I remember once at an animal rights conference, I said to the organizer, I wanted to speak about socialism and animal rights. And I wanted to talk about the relationship between economic justice and the economic reasons why we exploit animals. And he looked at me and said, you can't talk about socialism here. And I thought, wow, this is really very interesting. I mean, you know, you can't really understand animal exploitation unless you have some grounding in economics. You can't really understand why we do what we do with animals unless you understand capitalist economics.
Mm-hmm.
And to say that's sort of out of the scope of what we can talk about when we're talking about animal issues suggests to me that people really aren't interested in rethinking questions.
Well, it's outrageous.
It is. I agree with you. I mean, I think it's totally outrageous. And you know, I mean, I've also had Mark just, you know, adding on the business, you know, the thing I was just talking about. A lot of the nasty letters I've gotten over the years have been because I have protested the I'd rather go wear naked than wear fur campaigns. And I get letters from people, including a lot of letters from women, saying, what's wrong with women showing their bodies? Which, of course, misses the whole point of what I'm trying to argue. But, I mean, there is a very close relationship between sexism and speciesism, and there's a very close relationship in terms of the fact that we live in a society in which violence has become eroticized. And, you know, it's not just sadomasochistic pornography, but violence has become eroticized. And when you live in a culture in which violence is eroticized, it becomes really very difficult to dislodge a lot of the exploitation that affects humans and non-humans.
Gary, I'm gonna have to interrupt you. We're at the end of the hour. It's been fantastic to talk with you.
Have we been an hour?
Thanks
wow.
again. Stay tuned next week.
Thank you, Gary. It's been very great talking to you. You're very energized, and we could have talked for another hour, I think.
Yeah.
I had lots of questions left, but we'll have to wrap up. Thanks for listening to Animal
Rights. Sure. Well, thank you for having me on.